want to, over this week and next week, I want to try to kind of finish the major piece of Perek Yud Gimel, and then move on to Perek Yud Daled, which is the battle of Michmas, the battle itself. We've spent a lot of time talking about peripheral issues related to words, phrases, ideas, Pim, Ivri, relationship between Israel and the Plishtim. We had, at the very beginning of our discussion of this chapter, looked at the key part of the story, which was Shaul waiting for Shmuel, Shmuel's delay, consequences that it has for Shaul. And that's really the piece that I want to spend a little more time exploring in detail, because I think it requires more than just the initial glance that we gave it. We had talked about it from the perspective of the original test back in Perek Yud, and why Shaul goes to Gilgal. I want to reread the story and then try to look at it a little bit more in depth. So we're going to start with Pasuk Chet, or Pasuk Zayin, I should say. V'ivrim avru at hayarden eretz gad v'gilad, v'sha'ul odenu b'gilgal, v'chol ha'am chardu acharav. So the picture that's painted starts with the background. Everybody's afraid of the plishtim, they're all running. Sha'ul is gathering his army together in Gilgal. V'yochel shivat yamim l'moed asher Shmuel, v'lo ba Shmuel ha'Gilgal. Shaul waited 7 days to the point of the appointed time which Shmuel, Lamoed Asher Shmuel, there's a textual problem with this pasuk because it's missing the verb. It should say something like Lamoed Asher Shmuel Amar, or Lamoed Asher Shmuel Kava. Everybody with me?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But that's more stylistic than anything else. Lamoed Asher Shmuel, velo ba Shmuel. Shmuel didn't come. V'lo ba Shmuel l'Gilgal, v'yafetz ha'am me'alav. The people began to scatter. V'yomer Shaul, hagisha elai ha'ola v'ashlamim, v'ya'al ha'ola. So Shaul said, bring me the ola and the shlamim. So first of all, just as an aside, why do you need an ola and shlamim? What's the significance of the carbon here?
Is it like a victory?
Well, the battle hasn't started yet.
But maybe like to anticipate it.
Okay. He says later on in the same story that in anticipation of Shmuel's delay, Ufne Hashem lo chiliti. I can't start the battle without first offering a carbon. That's not an uncommon phenomenon. So many battles in Tanakh begin with a conversation between the Melech and God through the Urim V'Tumim, David HaMelech, through the Kohen. Usually that kind of, there's a shorthand, and it just says that they spoke to the Urim V'Tumim, or spoke to God through the Urim V'Tumim, but it's more likely that at the beginning of most battles there was some kind of tefillah, what we would translate as tefillah in our context. In the days of the Mikdash or the Mizbeach, they would have some kind of korban / tefillah, because you want to go into battle, you want God's assistance. So, Fnei Hashem lo chiliti is, or in this case, the olav hashlamim, he feels that it's necessary to bring those korbanot in order to be successful in the battlefield. So we'll see, that's part of the dynamic of the conversation between him and Shmuel. Vayal ha'ola, brought the korban ola. Vayhi kechalato l'ha'alot ha'ola, v'hinei Shmuel ba. Finished the ola, and Shmuel, Shaul, Shmuel, Shlomo, And Shmuel shows up. I think that there's, if you read the psukim subtly, that it Vayomer Shmuel Hagish Elai Ha'Ola Vashlamim Vayal Ha'Ola Vayikach Alato La'Alot At Ha'Ola Vinei Shmuel Ba.
It's in the middle of doing it.
Right. He got through the Ola. He hadn't yet gotten to the Shlamim. Right. That's what it seems like. And Shmuel just kind of shows
appeared.
Up. Vayitzei Shaul Likrato Levarcho. And Shaul goes running out to meet him. He's very pleased. Vayomer Shmuel, Me'asita? What did you do? That's not what Shaul, I don't think that's what Shaul anticipated as the response, but that was what he got. Vayomer Shaul, Ki ra'iti ki nafat sa'am me'alai. Ve'ata lo vata lemo'ed hayamim. The people were scattering. We were waiting and waiting and waiting. You didn't come. Uflishtim ne'esafim michmas. Plishtim are gathering at michmas. I can't wait. Va'omar atayir du plishtim elai gilgal ufnei Hashem lochiliti. I'm going to wait for you to bring the korban. It's a problem because I'm waiting for the plishtim. How long can I wait before the plishtim attack from michmas down to me in Gilgal? And it's more than just that the plishtim will attack. It's the plishtim will attack before I have a chance to bring the korban to Hashem. Ufnei Hashem lochiliti. Ve'tapak va'ale ha'ola. So I couldn't hold back, and I brought the korban. Vayomer Shmuel Shaul niskalta. Lo shamarta et mitzvat Hashem elokecha asher tzivach. You failed. God gave you one instruction and you didn't keep it. Ki ata echin Hashem et mamlachtacha al Yisrael ad olam. Had you kept it, God would have given you this kingdom for eternity.
He started a little early.
Excuse me?
He was on the seventh day. It wasn't like he didn't wait 7 days.
So, yeah.
I think that's a pretty strict. I mean, we start Shabbos early in the summer.
Yeah, but when the Nevi says to you, don't, right? So we're going to talk about how harsh this was. This is part of our agenda for this discussion today, next week, is to kind of zero in on what was the expectation and what were the consequences, meaning a little bit of question whether or not it was an over harsh judgment of Shaul. We're going to see. We're going to discuss a lot of this. V'yata mamlachtacha lo takum bikesh Hashem lo ish kilavavo. Now, God will seek somebody else. Would have given you the kingdom for eternity. Now he'll seek somebody else. V'etzaveu Hashem lenegid al amo ki lo shamarta et asher tzibacha Hashem.
That's pretty strict.
So mm-hmm. It was very strict, and essentially he says this is this is the time in which the decree is first articulated, that the kingdom is going to be taken away from him and given to somebody else. And at that point, Vayakam Shmuel Vayal Minah Gilgal Givat Binyamin Vayivkod Shaul Et Ama Nimtzim Mimok Yishesh Miyotish. Shmuel leaves, goes to Givat Binyamin, and Shaul looked at his people who had left, and he had 600 people. Shaul v'Yonatan by the Ingeva Binyamin, which is interesting that Shmuel goes back to Givat Binyamin, which is where Yonatan and his nar are. Ingeva Binyamin, uflishtim chanu b'michmas. So. I want to spend some time talking about this conversation because I think that there's a lot beneath the surface going on in this expectation from Shmuel to Shaul. Why does Shmuel delay? Why does he play this game with him? It almost reads as if he kind of almost sets him up to fail.
Yeah, it sounds like a test. Right?
It certainly does sound like a test. And in fact, we looked at the Pesukim back in Perek Yud in which this test was articulated. In other words, it's not a surprise that it's a test. Because back in Perek Yud, Shmuel had said to Shaul, in the list of tests that he gave him, or list of otot that he gave him. Ot number one, ot number two, ot number three, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And then at the very end, he says to him, V'yoradata lefanaya gilgal, v'ineh anochi yored elecha lalot olot. I'm looking back at Perek Yud Pasukhet. I'm just quickly glancing back at that phrase. V'yoradata lefanaya gilgal, v'ineh anochi yored elecha lalot olot lizbach zivchei shlamim. I'm going to come to you in Gilgal, you're going to wait, and I'm going to bring the Korban Ola and the Shlomim. Shivat Yamim Tochel Ad Bo'i Elecha. You wait for me for 7 days. Vadati Lechat Asher Ta'aseh. And I will instruct you on how to conduct this war. So already back in Perek Yud, Shmuel tells Shaul, this is, if you will, Ot number four, or test number four. This is your mivchan. You're going to go to Gilgal, the war with the Plishtim, and you're going to wait for me for 7 days. And I will bring the Korban Ola, I will bring the Korban Shlamim, and I will instruct you, and you will wait.
So it's not so harsh when you think about it. He's giving him these explicit instructions.
The instructions are very clear. You wait till I come.
Right.
I will bring the Korban Ola via Shlamim. And when he, 7 days, the sun is getting low over the hills, 7 days, he didn't come, the people are beginning to scatter, Shaul gets trigger happy.
Nervous.
Right? He's nervous. And I understand that he's nervous. I understand the sense of trepidation. What happens if something happened to Shmuel? What happens if he doesn't come?
That's part of a test.
And then the other part of the equation is, do the people know that he's supposed to wait for Shmuel for 7 days?
Right.
Unclear.
And also, he's a human being. I mean.
Right.
But he tells them that he's very specific.
And he was very specific. What?
But Shaul tells the people he's waiting for, doesn't he, when they're hot to go? He says, we have to wait for Shmuel. Earlier, I think. They're getting antsy. Like, he already held out, I think, from the text.
Doesn't ever say what he tells the people. But I expect that he said to them, okay, we have to wait for Shmuel. He'll come on Monday. You know, but Monday comes, and there's a big difference between Monday morning and Monday night. When the enemy is on the horizon and your people are not Shaul HaMelech, they're your rank and file soldiers, and they're beginning to scatter. And how long can Shaul hold out? And Shmuel comes at the very last second. Is it a game he's playing? Is it a test he's playing?
Also, when he tells him to go get the carbon or whatever, it sounds like, you know, like, I don't know, he's playing for time a little bit.
Right. So there is a parallel. I'm going to get to this at the end, but since we're here, there is an interesting parallel to the story of Chet Ha'Egel. The story of Chet Ha'Egel kind of hovers over this story as a kind of a shadow. There are a number of parallels. Now, I'm sorry, this isn't Hebrew. It's right out of my notes. I just thought it would be easier for you to follow along if I had this charted out. So what I did was I just kind of charted out in my notes what are the major parallels to this story in Chet Ha'Egel. So first of all, we have to recognize that in Shaul's defense of his actions, Shaul offers or makes three statements. Why did Shaul not wait for Shmuel? There are, in fact, in his response, three different answers, or three parts of his answer. Yomer Shmuel me'asita, back in our parak, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Yomer Shmuel me'asita, what did you do? Yomer Shmuel ki ra'iti ki nafatza ame'alai. יתה לו באת למועד הימים, ופלישתים נאספים מכמס, ואמר, אתה ירדו פלישתים אליי גגל, ופני השם לא חיניתי, ותפק לי ועלי העולה. I said, the people were scattering. I saw that the people were scattering. And you did not come to the right at the proper time. And the plishtim were gathering a mechmas and could attack at any time before I have a chance to bring the korban. So embedded in Shaul's answer, there are essentially three responses. Number one, ki ra'iti ki nafatza'am me'alai. I'm waiting for you, but in the meantime, I'm losing my men. I'm losing the army. I've got to fight this war, and you're forcing me to fight it with a smaller army. Number two, v'yata labata l'moed hayamim. What are you blaming me for? You were late. And number three, how could I start a war without bringing a korban? Right? I have to bring a korban. Can't start a war without bringing a korban. So if you look at the conversation between Shaul and Shmuel, there are, and you compare it to the conversation between Moshe and Aaron when Moshe comes down the mountain after Chet Ego, there are a number of very striking parallels. First of all, the whole context of the story. Right? You have two leaders. One is designated at a specific time by which he's supposed to return, and people are supposed to wait for him. He's late. So the other leader, in this case, right, Shaul on the one hand or Aaron on the other, steps in to kind of play a role in the delay of the primary leader, Shmuel on the one hand, Moshe on the other, the Navi, if you will. The people saw that Moshe was late coming down the mountain. We don't know what happened to Moshe. Moshe went up the mountain, he didn't come back. Shmuel gave him 7 days, and he didn't come. Almost as a parenthetical aside, there's also a parallel between the korbanot that they bring. The next morning after Aaron makes the egel, they bring korbanot to the egel. In this case, v'eshkimu mimachorat v'yalu olot v'yakishu shlamim. V'yeshev ha'am le'achol v'shato v'yakumu l'tzachek. There's also the olot and shlamim context. That's probably less significant. In the meantime, the leader shows up, and he challenges the second. He challenges Aaron on the one hand, or Shaul on the other. Vayomer Moshe el Aaron, Me asita, me asalacha amazek yevet alaycha ta'agdola, yevet alavcha ta'agdola. What did they do to you? Right, what did Shmuel say to Shaul? Me asita. What did you do? The response is also interesting. In Shaul's case, he justifies his actions. In Aaron's case, there's also an element of self-justification. Vayomer Aaron al yichar af odani, atayadata et ha'am ki berau. Says Aaron to Moshe, don't blame me. You know the nature of this people. It's their fault. So there is in both Aaron's response and Shaul's response a certain harshness, right? Of sort of discharging responsibility for the actions upon the people, and then a kind of a subtle throwback to say, it's not my fault, it's the people's fault, and it's partially your fault. Atalamata. Okay, you were late. In Shaul's case, v'talabata l'moed hayamim. In Shmuel's case, in Moshe's case, v'yamuli aseh lanu Elohim asher yorchu lefneinu ki zeh Moshe ish asher lanu me'eretz Mitzrayim lo yadanu me'ayalo. Now, if the Torah compares in language, if the Navi compares in language and context the story of Shaul's behavior to the story of Chet Ha'egel, that can only tell me one thing. That can only point to one conclusion.
Bad news.
Right. That there's a lot more significance and severity to this delay or to this breach of protocol than we would have otherwise have read. Because you want to compare this to Chet Ha'egel being one of the most significant moments in the generation that left Mitzrayim, for Shaul, this is his Chet Ha'egel. Which is harsh. So the question is, what is it in the story that was so significant for Shaul, that it was so powerful a moment, that the fact that he brought the korban, or the fact that he initiated, or the fact that he didn't wait for Shaul, or for Shmuel, or the fact that he took the initiative, whatever the breach was, what was it about the circumstances that was set up here, and that Shaul should have realized, that was so momentous, that this really is the point of, I wouldn't say the point of no return, but certainly the most significant breach so far that we have seen for Shaul. It's not the first breach. Okay, the first glimpse at a problem we saw was back in the, when he was being designated or coronated, when he was hiding. But there is here this is the first time the decree is articulated that his kingdom is on shaky foundation and it's going to crumble. He has a chance to...
The first thing was his own humility. It showed he wasn't seeking the power and, you know, he wasn't looking for any of that. You know, he was chosen, like Moshe also wasn't seeking to be an Avi, and, you know.
Right.
He also was trying to get out of it.
Right, so we talked about Shaul's humility and the comparison to Moshe. But we also talked about the moment of the distinction between them, or the difference between them, whereas Moshe's humility at a certain point gets put aside because of the mission and the mandate. With Shaul, at least initially, Shaul goes from one extreme to the other. He goes from a man who doesn't want the kingdom to a man who will do anything possible to hold on to the kingdom. And that's the end of the story with David. And that's part of the challenge with Shaul, is the transition from the humility of Nechbal HaKelim, he's hiding, to the person who will do anything to hold on to the power of the throne at the end of his life. Right? That transition is what we are essentially going to find in pieces of in Shaul's experience. So I'll come back to that piece of it. But I want to look at a number of different themes related to this request to wait for him and his lack of patience. There were a number of different pieces to the story. So first of all, on one level, on one basic level, Shaul's insistence that he has to go into battle with or without Shmuel at the right time essentially says to Shmuel, what he essentially says to Shmuel is, I'm the king, I'm running an army. If I don't go into battle now, I'm going to lose the army. And with or without you, I got to start. That's essentially what he says. I have to start with or without you. You want to give me 7 days? That's fine. Come day seven on time, and we can start. If you don't come on day seven on time, I got to start the battle. I can't wait for the Navi. The battle is more important than waiting for the Navi.
But I don't think that's a fair analysis. Because
it's not what he says.
I'm not saying what he says, but the bottom line is he is trying to wait, and his army's disappearing.
So we get to the army disappearing in a second.
He's panicking. Right.
And maybe the army disappearing is part of the test. Maybe God wanted the army to disappear.
I'm saying, like, if you right. They see your enemy on the next hill, and you know your army's disappearing.
I get it.
You don't know where the
I get it. When Gideon went into battle with 30,000, or gathered together an army of 30,000 soldiers to fight against Midian, and the combined forces of Midian, Amalek, and Bnei Kedem, and also described there as Kechol Asher Al Sfat Hayam, a nation so big and an army so big that they were like the sand of the sea. God comes to Shaul. Sorry, God comes to Gideon, and he says to him. What he says to him? Perek Zion. Shoftim Perek Zion. Shoftim Perek Zion. Start from the beginning of the parak. Vayashkem Yerubal hu Gidon v'chol ha'am asher ito v'yachanu al ein acharod u'machane migyan ayala mitzafon migivat ha'moreh ba'emek. Also, standoff. Shaul is Gidon is on one side, Midian is on the other side of the valley. Gidon has 30,000 soldiers. Correct? You remember that? Story familiar at all? Maybe. It will be in a second. Vayomer Hashem El Gidon, Rav Ha'am Asher Itach Mititi Et Midian Biyadam. You have too many soldiers. I'm not giving Midian into your hands with so many soldiers. Why? Penit Pe'er Ala Yisrael Emor Yadi Hoshioli. If you take 30,000 soldiers and you go to fight against this enormous army of Midian, what are you going to turn around and say at the end of the day? You'll be victorious. What are you going to say? You're going to say, there you go. Mi malal gvurot Yisrael. I did it. I did it. Ve'ata klana ba'ozne ha'am lemor mi yarei v'chared yashuv v'yitzbo mehar ha'gilad. So go and tell your people, anybody who's too afraid to fight, go home. Which, by the way, is also a mitzvah in the Torah. Go tell them if they're afraid, go home. Vayashu mina'am 22,000 left, 10,000 stayed. So 22,000 were there only because they were forced to be there. 10,000 left. 10,000 remained.
Well, they were given an out. They said if you're fearful, you could leave.
Right. So the moment they gave him an out, they took it. We're not finished. Vayomer Hashem al Gidon, Od Ha'am Rav. You still have too many soldiers. Hored otam al ha'mayim, ve'etzrefenu l'chasham. Go down, take them to the water, and I'll test them there. I will forge them there, meaning I will select out of these 10,000 the force with which you are going to go to fight against Midian. I'll give you a test. I'll tell you who you go to fight with. The rest of them are not coming. So he brought him down to the water. All those who go down to the water and lap the water up with their tongues, like a dog, who sit on their knees and bend over into the water to lap up the water, put them in one side. The remaining group, instead of using their tongues to lap up the water from the river with their tongues like a dog, they drank the water differently. What did they do?
They cupped their hands
and brought it to their mouths. Melakikim biyadam elpiyim. V'chol yeter ha'am kadua birkeim lishtot mayim. The rest of them bent over with their knees and into the water to drink water. V'yomer Hashem al Gidon b'shlosh mot ha'ish ha'melakikim oshia etchem. V'natati et midyam biyadecha. So against these 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 Midianites, you're going to take these 300 soldiers and you're going to go to fight. And the rest of them you're going to send out. Now,
do you know what the lapping like a dog?
Right. So we had talked about this in Sefer Shoftim, and we had offered several possible explanations as to why, what the nature of this test was about. One explanation, which is essentially brought down in many of the Mefarshim, is that the issue was whether they were going down on their knees. that in order to get to the water, they had to go on their knees, which means, says Rashi and Hadak and others, that they were used to bending on their knees. They're used to bending on their knees means that they were used to the rituals of idolatry. We don't want them. Anybody who's so quick and comfortable to kind of bend on the knees, you know, there's an interesting halacha, I think we talked about this once before, that you're not allowed to sit on your knees. Because sitting on your knees is like bowing. So that's essentially the context here. There's another possibility, which I think has more more potency in the pshat of the story, which is that if you take a group of soldiers who are thirsty, but who are in the middle of readiness for battle, and you take them down to the water because they're thirsty and you get them to drink, those who sit on their knees and who put their face in the water to drink means that they are essentially, they've let their guard down, because if you're in the middle of a war and you could be attacked at any moment, the last thing you want is a soldier who, at the moment he sees water to quench his thirst, is going to put down his weapon and put his face in the water and start lapping up the water like a dog. What you want are soldiers who, even if they're thirsty, and even if they're hungry, are going to have the self-discipline to keep one hand on their sword while they use the other to bring the water to their mouths, so that they always stay ready. You're going to go to battle against 300 people. You don't want those 300 people to be people who are, at the first sign of trouble, are going to run. You want 300 people who are going to understand that their victory is dependent upon God and not upon the strength of numbers. And so you need people who have courage. And remember, in Sefer Shoftim, courage is always a reflection of emunah. What's the term used in Shoftim to describe people who have courage? Atitzlach alav ruach Hashem. There's a correlation between the kind of courage needed to go into battle and this kind and deep-seated emunah in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Gideon is told, you're going to take 300 men into battle. 300 men whom I will choose, who I guarantee will have the kind of fortification and the kind of emunah to be able to withstand this battle. And with those 300 men, you're going to wipe out the army of Midian. The rest of them will come later. But you're going to start this battle with 300. When Yonatan starts the battle of Michmas, it's Yonatan and his Na'ar against the entire army of the Plishtim. What does Yonatan say to his lad when he attacks? Talked about this. This is in Perek Yudalid, but we talked about this a bit. Right, what does he actually say to him? Why is two people, Yonatan and his Noseke Lav, going to go and attack the entire camp of the Plishtim? So if you look at Perek Yudalid, Pasuk Vav, Vayomer Yonatan al Nar Elanar Nosekilav Lechav Nabral Matzav Arayli Meile Ulay Yase Hashem Lanu Ki Ein La Hashem Atzor Lo Shir Berava B'Maat, because God can protect. God can save us whether we're few or many, whether it's two against the Plishtim or 2,000 or 20,000. On the contrary, from the perspective of Tanakh, it's not uncommon for the Navi to say, no, I prefer that you go to battle with 300 than with 30,000. Let the odds be against you 100 to 1. Why? Because then when you're victorious, you know who to thank. So Shaul is sitting there in Gilgal, and we have no idea what the size of his army is in that initial stage. We know that in Michmas he had 2,000 soldiers, but it says in Pasuk Vav, back in Perek Yud Gimel, it says in Pasuk Zayin, V'chol ha'am chardu acharav. Shaul went to Gilgal to gather the army. So if he started with 2,000, I have no idea how many he gathered together in Gilgal. It could be that over the course, right, he blew the shofar and he grabbed the people, and he had blown the shofar back in Pasuk Gimel, V'shaul takab shafar. And the Ivrim are going, and it could be that he gathered together a force of 5,000, 10,000. We don't know. We do know that Shmuel doesn't come at the appointed time right away, and the people began to scatter. And much like Gidon, back in Perek Zion, much like Gidon, the ones remaining, in Gideon's case was 300, in Shaul's case is 600, but they're the ones who are going to remain because Shmuel said to them to wait. They're the ones who are going to remain because Shmuel said to remain. And that's the ones that, those are the ones that the Navi wants him to go to battle. So there is in this story a kind of a throwback to Shoftim and to the sense that size of the Rebbe Shem doesn't want the size of the army to be extreme. And on the contrary, when Shaul says "Ki nafatza ami alai," you can see Shmuel kind of internally saying to himself, "Exactly, that's the point. That was the point, and you missed it." That's part one. We're not finished because there's more to the story. Another throwback to Sefer Shoftim that Shaul should have understood, again, given the role that he played and the relationship that he had with the Navi, these are all part of the expectation of the story.
Does Shaul know the story of Gidon?
I would assume that these stories were well known. I have to assume this is 300 years, 350 years of history. I would assume these were legends, these were stories, these were significant. I mean, it's true that Sefer Shoftim is written by Shmuel as a record, as a text, but I would have to assume that the stories were well known. The use of terminology and language repeats itself so often that I can't believe that they wouldn't have been well known.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. There's another piece to the story.
People are so ignorant today, you know.
Yeah, but today is different. These are people whose relationship with the Navi was profound. Shmuel and Shaul. A piece of the story that we miss is that Shaul and Shmuel's relationship is such that we only have a few interactions between them recorded in Sefer Shmuel. But we know that there was a deep-seated, profound love between them. Shmuel loved Shaul. Shmuel was deeply connected to Shaul. He was his protege. He trained him. He hired. He anointed him. He designated him. He gave him. I can't believe that there was only these two or three moments where they interacted. That this is years in the making. And so Shmuel's constantly encouraging him, explaining to him, defining for him the mandate and the role. This was his test.
Because when you read the text, you don't get the passage of time. It seems like very quickly from the time he was anointed until this happened.
Right, but we already talked about the passage of time. Right? That there's the transition. It's more than 2 years. It's the whole. First of all, it's the whole failure or the whole disruption of the army, and the gap time between Perek Yud Bet and Yud Gimel. That was one of the previous issues, right? The rain in the spring and the consequences that it had.
Yeah.
Suspicion is that there was a significant period of time that had lapsed.
Between that and...
And Shaul's battles that he fought and Shmuel's encouragement, etc. And they had a very deep relationship. I have to believe that Shaul understood that this, or Shmuel was testing Shaul. Shaul may have even understood that this was a test. He just saw other factors as more critical than the factors that Shmuel had laid out before. There's another factor from Sefer Shoftim that I think is relevant here, and that is the role of the relationship between the Navi and the battle. Key battles in Tanakh, with which begin with either the Navi instructing the Melech, or even in cases accompanying the Melech. In order to be able to say to the Melech, this is where the battle begins. For example, let's go back one step from Gidon. Devorah and Barak. Remember the story of Devorah and Barak?
Mm, yes.
When Barak says to Devorah, I'll go into battle against Yavin Melech, against Sisra and Yavin Melech Knan, on one condition.
You go with me.
You go with me. Why? Because she was the
representative of Hashem.
She was the Navi. She was the Navi. She was the representative of Hashem. She carried with her, in proverbial terms, the equivalent of the staff of Moshe. And she was the Navi. And the Melech wanted the Navi with him so that she could say to him, as she does, right, when the battle begins, she turns to Barak and she says to him, Vatomer Dvorah el Barak, Kum, ki ze hayom asher natan Hashem et Sisra biyadecha. Alo Hashem yatza lefanecha. Okay, Barak, this is, you called me into battle for one reason, so that I could tell you when God was with you. Ki Hashem yatza lefanecha. God has gone out before you. When the Navi comes to assist in the battlefield, it's because the Navi has a role to play in defining the outcome of the battle and knowing when to attack. And knowing when, to put it into cosmic terms, knowing when the Tzva Hashem, the Malachim that are going to assist them in battle, are going to be there for them. The last thing in the world you want to do is to go to battle with the 300 men of Gidon or the 600 men of Shaul, and not have the Malachim of the Rebbeinu Shlom watch your back. For that you need the Navi. Just to give you a contrast, jump to Shmuel Bet. Well, we're moving ahead. Okay. See how far we've gotten? Shmuel Bet. Perek Hay. Say an interesting battle. An interesting battle. Perek Hay is David. David's war against the Plishtim, no less. Okay, so if you really want to draw the parallel. Starting with Pasuk Yud. Yud. Zion. Vayishmu Plishtim. Everybody have it? Vayishmu Plishtim ki mashchu et David lemelech Yisrael. Beginning of Perek Hay, David becomes the king over the united kingdom of Israel. The Plishtim heard. Vayalu ko Plishtim levakesh et David. So they came to find David. To come to find David didn't mean they came to give him a gift for his coronation. They came to find David, to settle the score with him. Vayishma David vayered el hametzuda. David heard. He went to the mitzvah. There's a whole discussion about the mitzvah. It appears a number of different places in Sefer Shmuel what the mitzvah is. For now, we're going to leave it. Uflishtim bau vayinatshu be'emek Rephaim. Plishtim came, and they spread out in Emek Rephaim. This battle is taking place remarkably close to Yerushalayim.
Is it the same as the street?
Yeah. Emek Rephaim is in this Emek. Emek Rephaim, it's a valley.
Mm-hmm.
Emek Rephaim is called Emek Rephaim because it's a valley.
Okay. I've been there.
It's exactly
up and down.
Okay. In those days, it was just a valley. Veishal David b'Hashem lemor ha'ele el plishtim hatitnem biyadi. So David turns to the Kohen, to the Urim v'Tumim, and he says, okay, tell me, do I go to battle? Can't go into war without God's approval. If God says yes, you go. If he says no, you don't go. That's the fundamental principle of Malchut Yisrael. Vayomer Hashem el David, Ale, ki naton eten et haplishtim biyadecha. Go. I will give them into your hands. Vayefo David, Baal Paritzim, Vayakem Shem David. There's a battle that David begins to the war. Vayomer parat Hashemet oivai lefanai kiperetz mayim alken kva Hashem makom ahu baal peretzim v'yazu Hashemet atzavem v'yisaim David v'anashav. Victorious, brings the bones of the plishtim back. V'yisifu od plishtim la'alot v'yinatishu be'emek Rephaim. Second campaign of the Battle of Emek Rephaim. And this time, Vayishal David Ba'Hashem Vayomer Lo Tale. This time God said to him, no. This is a really powerful example. What God said the first time, he said to him, go. And the second time he said, no, David, you're not going yet. Hasev el acharehem. Go around them. Uvatalem mimul b'chaim. And come behind them. Vayihi, listen to this pasuk carefully. Vayihi, kishama'acha et kol tza'ada b'rashay ha'b'chaim az ticharatz. When you can hear, you know the old expression, wait till you can see the whites of their eyes? Mm-hmm. When you can hear the marching of the feet, then you can attack. Why? Ki az yatza Hashem lefanecha la'akot b'machaneh plishtim. Because then God is with you. Whose feet are you hearing?
The enemy, no?
No.
Theirs? Their own?
No.
The ghost of Emek Rephaim?
Close. What does ki az yatsa Hashem lefanecha mean?
The host, the heavenly host?
In the language of Tanakh, there's always a second army that fights with us. That's the Malachim. When Yaakov comes back from Laban's house to meet Esau with 400 people, and he comes and he encounters the Malachim who he encountered on his way out of Israel, and he encounters the Malachim on the way back in the end of Parshat Vayeshev, before Vayishlach, it says, Vayifga b'makom, Vayira machane Elokim, Malachi Elokim, he encounters a place, he sees Malachi Elokim as he's coming back to Eretz Yisrael, and he calls the place Machanaim. What's Machanaim?
Like a
double camp. Remember, the word Machane in Tanakh does not mean summer camp. The word Machane in Tanakh means military camp. He sees a group of angels, and he calls the place the double camp. Why the double camp?
Because
he has two armies. He's got his army, and he's got an army of Malachi Elokim. So he calls the place Machanayim. There's even a theory I heard once from one of my rabbis that when Yaakov splits the camp in half, Yachatz at the Machanei Shelo, and he takes half the camp and he says, well, if Yosef comes and attacks the first camp, the second will go. And you always ask the question, okay, who did he put into the front? Which one of his wives and children did he put into the first camp? So the expendable ones versus which ones he kept in the second camp who can run away. Right? So the answer is neither. He split the camp by the Machanayim. The Machanei Elokim, the angels, went first. If Esav could hit the angels, then the rest of his camp would run.
Wow, I always thought he put like Leia in.
Right. Right. So that's complicated. I much prefer the impression. Much prefer the interpretation that he split it with the same Machanayim that he had. This is when you hear the feet stomping, the feet marching, then you'll know ki az yitzah Hashem lefanecha. Right? When you're Davin HaMelech, you can hear angels' feet. That's exactly the point. When you're Yaakov Avinu, you can fight with Tzva Hashem. What did God say to Yeshua as he stood outside the walls of Yericho and he sent him a vision? And he sees, and remember the story of the beginning of Yericho? He looks up and he sees a person who looks like a soldier with his sword staff. So stretched out. Remember the story?
No, I just remember them marching around the wall 7 times.
Where are we?
Yoshua Perek Hay. Let me show you my favorite story in all of Tanakh. I've showed you this before. Vayi biyot Yeshua bi Yericho.
Which pasuk?
Which pasuk? End of Perek Hey.
263.
563. Perek Hey, pasuk Gimel, 513. Vayi biyot Yeshua bi Yericho. Yeshua is encamped just outside of Yericho. Vayisa einav vayar, v'hine ish omed l'negdo v'charbosh l'fa biyado. Standing in front of him is a man with a sword. A man with a sword. Vayech Yeshua elav, vayomer lo, alanu ata im litzareinu. Tell me, man with a sword, are you for us or against us? Meaning, friend or foe, who are you? Vayomer, lo, neither. Ki ani sar tzva Hashem. I am the general of God's army. Ata bati, I've come now. The moment Yeshua sees that he's talking to a malach, vayipol Yeshua panav arza, vayishtarcho, vayomer lo, ma adoni medaber alavdo. Tell me, what are my instructions? So he says to him, first of all, Yomer Sar Tzva Hashem al Yeshua, Shal Nalcha Me'al Aglecha, Ki Makom Asher Ta Omed Lav Kodeshu, first take your shoes off because you're standing on holy ground, like Moshe at the Sneh, Me'as Yeshua Kain, V'yiricho Sugeret Tumus Sugeret, Ebnei Yisrael, En Yotzei Vein Ba, Yiricho is surrounded. God then says to Yomer Hashem al Yeshua, I've given Yiricho into your hands, here are the instructions, go surround it 7 times with the trumpets in 7 days and the walls are going to fall. This Malach comes to give Yeshua the instructions of how to destroy the walls of Yiricho. Sar Tzva Hashem. This isn't just a term that we throw around, Sar Tzva Hashem. This is what Tanakh is built on. When you go into battle, you go into battle not with your army of 50,000 soldiers or 30,000 soldiers. You go into army with however many God gives you, and the rest of them, the Tzva Hashem. And the Malach comes to tell him, I run the army of God.
Is this pasuk also in Haggadah about...
It's a pasuk. That's a different pasuk. It's a pasuk in.
But there is something with the
sword. Right. It's a story of David by Yerushalayim. It's a different story.
Why, when he asks him if he's friend or foe, why isn't he friend?
Well, he is friend, but he's neither because he's not a human being. Right. Right, he thought he was a soldier.
But he's there to help him.
He's there to help him, but he thought he was a soldier. So he says, I'm not a soldier. In the sense of from your camp or the enemy's camp, I'm a malach. Which is an interesting observation to itself that he didn't recognize that he was a malach. Once we think of malachim as a kind of
one leg.
One leg and wings.
Well, a lot of times they say Ish and it's a malach and they don't know it's a
right.
malach. Like
Yosef, and we have it by Gidon, and we had it, you had it by Shimshon and Abraham, correct. But here's another very powerful example where the Malach comes to tell Yeshua, who's the general, you can't go into battle without the Tzva Hashem. Here's, right, so I've come to help. So Shmuel says to Shaul, you're going to go into battle against this enormous army of the Plishtim. You're going to do so when I come to bring you the assistance of the Navi and the Navi and all that the Navi represents. So you're afraid that your 2,000 soldiers have gone down to 600? Who cares? If you truly understood the moment, it wouldn't matter how many are left. You wait for the Navi. Give you one more example, since we are one more example. This one I've shared with you. My favorite story in Tanakh. Malachim Bet Perek Vav. I don't know why it's my favorite story. I just have a particular
liking. But you said Yeshua was your favorite story.
No. I said Yeshua. I'll tell you what my favorite story is.
Okay.
No, my favorite story is the Elisha and his Na'ar.
Okay.
That's, I've told you this before.
Or 48.
Malachim bet
Which pasuk? So we'll see. So we're gonna. There's parts of the story. We got a little bit of background to the story we need to have. There's an ongoing battle. We call it a war of attrition between Israel and Aram at this time.
So is Aram like Syria?
Aram is, location-wise, Aram is will eventually become Ashur, which will eventually become Bava, which will eventually become Paras, and right? all of the kingdoms of the of Mesopotamia, right? They just
so
go
it's
from
more like Aram.
That's that whole region, right? Umelach Aram ayah nilcham pasukhet, v'umelach Aram ayah nilcham b'Yisrael. Melech Aram ayah nilcham b'Yisrael, v'yivalitz al avadav lemor amakom ploni almoni tachanoti. King of Aram would war against Israel. He would tell his advisors, "Go, let's go camp over here." V'yishlach ish helokim al melech Yisrael lemor ishame me'avor amakom hazeh kisham Aram nechitim. Wherever he would camp, the Ish Elokim, the Navi, would come to the king of Israel to tell him, oh, don't go through that valley, because the army of Aram is in that valley. Kitzer, this poor king of Aram, he can't get a break, because every time he finds a new hiding place from which to ambush Israel, Israel finds out, like Israel's got this great spy satellite system that tells them every time Aram's army moves. And therefore, Vaishlach Melech Yisrael el makom asher amalo ishu elokim v'yizhiro v'nishma Hashem. So the king of Israel would tell his army, don't go here, because God had, through the Navi, had told him. Lo achat lo shtayim, this went on once, twice, this went on over and over again. Vayisa'er lev Melech Aram al hadavar hazeh. Melech Aram is angry. He doesn't understand how it is that Israel keeps getting a jump on his military strategy. Now, if you were the king of Aram, what would be your suspicion?
Spy.
Right. Calls over his advisors and says, okay, which one of you is the spy? So one of his servants says to the king of Aram, Lo Adoni HaMelech, Ki Elisha Navi Asher B'Yisrael Yagid LeMelech Yisrael Et HaDvarim Asher Tadaber B'Chadar Mishkavecha. Melech Aram, you got it wrong. We don't have a spy here. They've got a spy in the heavens. They got a spy in the Navi. This Navi, he can tell you what you whisper in the secrets of your bedchamber. So Vayomer Lechur Uecho Uveshlach Vekacheu. So Melech Aram says, okay, I got to go take out their secret weapon. Tell me where this Navi is. I'll go kill him. Vayigadlo Lemor Inei B'Dotan. So they said, okay, this Navi is in Dotan. Vaishlach Shama Susim Virechev Chayil Kaved. So to Dotan they send the entire army. Not to fight against the army of Israel, but to take out Elisha.
Vayvo Laila Hisham.
No. Elisha, the Navi. Vayavo Laila Viakifuela Ir. So comes the morning and the night and they surround the city. So in the morning, the na'ar, the assistant of Elisha, gets up in the morning and went outside to get the newspaper. Vayetze went out of his house. And surrounding his house is an entire army of horses and chariots and soldiers. They've got them surrounded, literally. Vayomer na'aro elav. So the na'ar says to Elisha, Aha, Adoni, Eicha na'aseh. Whoa, my master, what will we do? We are outnumbered 10,000 to 1. Vayomer. So Elisha says to his na'ar, listen to the answer that he gives him. Al tira, don't be afraid. Kirabim asher itanu ma'asher otam. Because we outnumber them. Wow. Listen to his answer. We outnumber them. We, you and me, Elisha and his na'ar, we outnumber them. So now if you were the na'ar, What would you think for a second?
I'd like to be drinking what he's drinking.
He's right. Nuts.
Crazy.
He's nuts.
Right.
He's
right.
Crazy.
Exactly. Vayitpalel Elisha vayomar. And listen to Elisha's tefillah. Elisha doesn't pray that Hashem should send a miracle. It's not what he prays. What he says is, Hashem, pekachna et einav v'yireh. Open up the eyes of the na'ar so that he can see what I see. Vayifkach Hashem et einei ha'na'ar. God opened the eyes of the na'ar. Vayar. When he opened up his eyes, he saw that the city was really surrounded, the mountain was surrounded by chariots and horses made of fire. His master Eliyahu had gone up to heaven in a chariot of fire. Made of fire. Elisha commands an army of sus varechev made of esh. Ele varechev, ele vasusim, enachnu b'shem Hashem alakenu nazkir. These horses and chariots of fire came down. And what do the Malachim do? So the Malachim don't fight in the traditional sense, right? They're not fighting ghosts. The Malachim are a way of Shliach Hashem, of assisting. So Shaul, Elisha says to him, okay, Malachim, here's your job. Your job is to blind the army. Make them all blind so they can't see. They all turn, get blind. No, they don't have a clue as to why. So Elisha comes out to them and he says, once they're all blind, tell me, what are you looking for? So he says, we're looking for Elisha. So he says, okay, I'll take you to Elisha. And he brings them into the heart of the city in which the army of Israel can now surround them and opens up their eyes. Now they can see, and they see that they're surrounded by the army of Israel. So there's a lot of eyes opening up in that story. But the takeaway from it is, and that's the critical takeaway from it is, that the Navi commands an army of Malachim. And the Navi can see what the average human being cannot. So when Devorah says to Barak, Kum, ki yetza Hashem lefanecha, go, God is with you, she's seeing the Malachim fighting mina kochavim b'mesilotam, the shooting stars above, and can tell the king, now you go and fight. Right? When David is in the middle of his battle and he hears the footsteps of the Malachim, Hashem says to him, ki yetza Hashem lefanecha. And Shmuel says to Shaul, you wait for me for 7 days, and I will lead you into battle. I'll tell you what to do. And poor Shaul is sitting there. He's watching his clock, watching his clock, watching his clock. He's watching his army. He's got 300 men. Is it 600 men? 600 men? I can't fight an army with 600 men. So what are you talking about?
So he should have known is what
Gideon fought a battle with 300 men. The Navi comes to you. You don't have what to worry about. And this is a subtlety that Shaul needs to understand in his relationship with the Navi. And that's a critical piece that's missing. David gets it. This is a piece that Shaul doesn't get. So, just to recap for a second, we've looked at this, the challenge to Shaul, or the expectation of Shaul, from several perspectives. Number one, the notion that God is intentionally whittling down the army size in order that you go to war when you're significantly outnumbered. You can't go to war with, you know, in Israel today they have the expression the qualitative edge. They always have to have the military qualitative edge. Right? That qualitative edge, in biblical terms, is exactly what the Navi doesn't want the king of Israel to have. He wants the qualitative edge to be on the side of the enemy. So that when they're victorious because God says so and not because the people do. And that's part of the challenge for the people. That's why they wanted a king in the first place. They didn't want that dependence. But the Navi says you don't have a choice.
So maybe we shouldn't support APAC.
In theological terms, it's a challenge. Right? In theological terms, it's a challenge for us to build an army based on qualitative edge. And the reality is, Look at the reaction to Israel's victory. I mean, if you look at modern Israel and the history of its victories and challenges, the most significant victories that achieved the most significant spiritual response were when we were really outnumbered.
Yes,
that's 48, interesting. Okay, 48, 67. Okay, when we were not outnumbered, when we outgunned our enemies, and we, even if we won the war, but we ended up kind of in a stalemate, like Lebanon, first Lebanon War, 73 for sure, first Lebanon War, second Lebanon War. Okay, the reactions, the responses have been very different. I'm not advocating disarmament, but. From a Navi's perspective, if we had Navim, it would be different. In a Navi's perspective, it's exactly the point.
So if we had Navim, we wouldn't support
APAC. Leave APAC out of the picture for now. It's complicated.
We're trying to help. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. And from the military, from the Navi's perspective, it's exactly what Shaul was challenged with. He says, "I can't go to war with only 600 men." And essentially, the message of the Navi is, "You can and you will, because that's what you need to do. You need to wait for me. That's far more important. My presence here and my role and your obedience and loyalty to Dvar Hashem is far more important than whether you have 600 soldiers or 1,000 soldiers."
We need a Navi.
Yeah, we need an
army. Now, there's two more pieces to the story that we haven't addressed, which I will not be able to do today, but we will, Bezat Hashem, look at next week, and then we will begin Perek Gedalia.